Almost 20. Hard to believe, huh, Jess?
Yeah, I can't believe it, Lynch.
Yeah, I know. Well, today, so episode...
When did you start these?
I started them in August, remember?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've been talking about this since, like, forever.
Since, like, January or so,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, every day. I'm going to do a podcast.
Well, no, over Christmas, because my cousin Eric and I talked... Yeah, I was going to do a podcast. I didn't ever realize I was actually going to do it in my tub, though. So I'm actually in my tub. You can hear the water. Taking a bubble bath with rainbow stars.
Rainbow stars everywhere.
Everywhere. It's unbelievable. My guest today... What's that? Yeah, I'm in my element. I'm with my elephant. My guest today is Johnny Vogelsang. He's a bass player here in Austin. He's played with a lot of people. Susanna Schaffel. He was in the band Sheboygan, who does our theme song. I don't think he played on that, but he was in the band at one point. He played with me. He played with Bob Schneider. He's played with a lot of different bands. Namely, he was in the band The Gingerbread Men that was around for a long time, and he and I were in bands at the same time then that actually had a residency together for a year in a place called Steamboat. So I met him this morning at a coffee shop, and I went to this place called The Spider House, which is by campus. And now it's not just a coffee shop, it's a full bar. And so it was weird because when I got there at 8:30 this morning, there were these guys that were like 50. There was like four guys that were like in their 50s, and they're sitting around. Obviously, they don't have jobs right now because they kind of talked about jobs in the past tense while I was standing there. And they were drinking away. They were on like their second and third drinks. God bless those guys. That was a weird scene. Anyway, it was weird to see guys drinking that.
Hey, Johnny, you want another shot?
And then I, no, thank you, though. Then I thought to myself, well, man, it might be kind of cool to have a drink that early. But then I thought, no, because it was just a little bit too early on a Tuesday. Anyway, so my guest is Johnny Vogelsang. He's a musician here in town. I have a lot of good shows coming up. I have Bruce Mahart. He's an author, one of my very best friends. He was in my very first band. He is coming over and is going to stay over and doing the podcast. I went to go see him speak with a few other authors at the book festival on Sunday with my friend Mark, and it was pretty intense. It was amazing. It was great to see him up, you know, with guys. You know, when you know someone since they were like, you know, 12 or 13. It's pretty amazing to see them be grown-up authors and with other authors being authors. They're all smart and whatever, well-spoken. So anyway, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to get together with Kelly Willis. I'm meeting Taylor from the Quiet Company. So we're finally going to get those underway. And so that's where I'm at right now, man, with these podcasts. So it looks like we're going all the way through about 22, at least. Anything else we should add?
There's going to be more than 22.
All right, here's Johnny Vogelsang.
I'm trying to preserve my word. Not a sound should be heard unless it's beautiful.
So I think we got a good level here. I might turn it up just a little bit. I got a compressor. I'm gonna run it through at home, so it'll work out great. John Vogelsang.
Yes.
Johnny V to my Johnny.
Can I help
G.
you?
Yes. What are you doing? What are you doing these days? You're about to go to school today.
Yes, I'm in school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're studying.
I'm studying jazz performance at the Butler School of Music at University of Texas here in Austin.
Yeah. How does that? What are you hoping to gain out of that?
I don't really know. No. Trying to get this degree so I can do some better teaching when I'm older.
Right. I would like some college teaching. College level
something
music teaching.
I don't know. I think I just like learning stuff and definitely want to get a degree, and you know, since I have a kid and everything.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah.
And so I've already been teaching for like 10 years at this place, Austin School of Music, and it's pretty cool. It's like lessons, you know, all the time, and a lot of beginners, a lot of Taylor Swift and stuff like that.
Right. Do you teach bass or you teach guitar? You teach
I teach both. Bass, guitar, and yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes piano.
How's that? Are you a good piano player? Beginner. I never knew that.
Yeah, well,
I figured
yeah.
you would be if you're you
well,
know,
yeah,
a studied
I played
musician
it when I was I played it when I was a kid, and I haven't practiced enough to be like a piano player. Like,
right.
But yeah, I'm mostly a bass player. Definitely
yeah.
a bass player.
Yeah, definitely. That's what you've been
yeah.
known as for a long
yeah.
time. So let me ask you this: when did you start taking lessons? Did you grow up in Houston? Did you?
No, I grew up in San Antonio.
Oh, you did?
Yeah,
okay.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about that. You were born there?
Yes.
Okay. So you're born and raised in San Antonio.
Yes, I was born and raised in San Antonio. Went to Taft High School. I was in band and choir. And
what did you play in band? What was your?
I played the trombone.
Uh-huh. Was that doled out to you, or did you choose the trombone yourself?
I think it was doled out to me. It
yeah.
was so long ago. Somehow I remember I wanted to play clarinet because I thought it looked cool.
Yeah.
It has all the keys and everything.
It's really kind of like, well, that was at the 80s, right? What good was
yeah.
clarinet going to do you then at that point? It sounded like it was the time of Benny Goodman where he was like bitching to be like, whoa, he plays clarinet.
I don't think I really knew back then. I was just a kid, you know, I was just a kid and I thought it looked cool.
Right.
Clarinet
okay.
looked cool. But anyways, they took one look at my, you know, my big lips and everything and said,
trombone.
Here, try this. Maybe they needed trombone players and they conned me into playing it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's so they kind of pointed it out to you.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you did that. So did you at that point know that you wanted to be a musician, or did you have a different trajectory going on? Were you going to be a fireman, or how old were you then?
How old was I? That was like elementary school going to middle school.
Okay.
So honestly, I've wanted to be a musician like forever.
Yeah.
Like yeah.
What was it? What was the thing that told you that that's what you wanted to do? Did you grow up in a musical family? Did you know musicians? Or
no, I mean, my parents had appreciation for music. They definitely liked music, but I think I just responded to it immediately when I was a kid, and just, you know, I just thought it was the funnest thing, you know, to
do,
to make noises
yeah.
and you know, in time. And
yeah,
and I just thought it was really cool. And then, of course, when I got into rock and roll, of course, then it just drove me insane, right?
So, right. Then
like,
it was different.
Yeah, I think Back in Black was my first records.
Okay.
And then Aerosmith, Toys in the Attic.
Right.
And Rush, Moving Pictures.
Right.
I vividly remember these records that I had, and they were records, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, you'd look at them for
was,
a long time.
And yeah, you know the names of every player on the
yeah.
record, and you know, I think when I was like,
it's
was
one
a
of the things
kid,
that
yeah.
kind of pisses me off about iTunes is that I don't have that experience anymore when I get a record. Like, when I buy a record, sometimes I don't, this isn't like a bitching about technology thing, but it's like I miss the act of sitting down, and I always knew. Sometimes I'd meet someone in
yeah.
a situation, you know.
Yeah.
You know, with a bunch of musicians, someone was in town. And you're like, holy shit! I know you're the guy that played the thing on this record that I, you know.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. We're like people from our generation. We're like encyclopedias.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because we can
totally.
It kind of cracks me up sometimes, like when you can name every member of like Iron Maiden or. Or
did
something.
When you looked at these records, did you know what these people did? Did you know what a engineer, or assistant engineer, what a producer was, or were these mysteries? Were these things you were trying to find out what to do?
More or less. I mean, when you're obsessed like that, when you're a kid, you do a lot of like research.
Yeah.
I mean, you just like you get you
yeah.
try to find everything you can. Buy those heavy metal magazines.
Yeah.
And, And so I like
that, was
pop
that your
too.
First was that your first hard rock? Hard rock really spoke to you, like in a. And then did you pick up the bass then?
Or
did
no, I played guitar actually. You did. So since I was, I played guitar like about, I think when I was about 11 or mm-hmm. something, so I played guitar all through. I took classical guitar and. Because I was inspired by Randy Rhoads and Yngwie Malmsteen.
Yeah, so Randy was a pretty moving musician. I'm not a huge Yngwie fan, but Randy definitely spoke to a lot of people and made a lot of people pick up a guitar. You know.
Yeah, I mean, Yngwie is ridiculous now. I mean, nobody would actually listen to that music.
is good. This is good because I want to talk about the merit of that music, because I always downplay it and I never know if it's because I actually am not that good of a musician that I can't even get my head around it, so I don't want to hear it. But there's other kinds of music like that, like jazz, that I love listening to.
So
what is that about that? Like, what do you think? That's the other thing too, is I never knew what those guys, like, what's Yngwie trying to tell me? You know what I mean? Like other guys, they have a story to share. This guy, is this guy literally just trying to show me how fast he can go?
I think
or
so.
Or is he trying to bring something out of me?
All I know is that when I was about 14, I saw Yngwie in concert, and of course it blew me away. Because he had all the fireworks. He played behind his back. He threw his guitar up in the air. He played those arpeggios that were perfect. And, you know, it was just like... Yeah, it was an amazing thing that somebody can do that, you know. So, I guess when I was a kid, that's kind of like what it just made a big impression on me.
Right.
Like, wow, he's a great musician because he can play these scales really fast.
Right.
Accurately.
I'm sorry to get off of this, but did you start a band? You got a guitar. You got into Yngwie. You got into Randy.
Yes, we had some bands in high school.
let's see. We have any names? Because this is one of my favorite parts about this.
Well, there's one called the Cranial Crabs. And I remember there was a piece of artwork with a guy's head kind of, his top's cut off, and there's a band inside of his head. And
band going on inside of his head?
Yeah, like a couple of bands, like, you know, like kind of like an Escher or something. And it said, Pinching Your Brain was the name of the record.
So you guys made a record?
No, it was just an imaginary record.
Drawn on notebook paper. Of course.
Yeah.
I used to do that a lot of that as well.
Yeah, but it was good times. That was more like punk rock. That was more like the Sex Pistols, Ramones. We were into
Did you guys write songs at that point, or did you?
Yes, we wrote some songs.
What were they like? Do you remember any? What were they about? You were 14, 15?
Yeah, they were. One was called "Mommy, Why Does Daddy Have AIDS?"
Are you kidding me?
No.
So you guys are smart kids. That's the thing, is that you have to have some kind of intelligence to come up with something that subversive at 14 or 15.
Yeah, it was very anthemic. I think it had a 1-4-5 chord progression in E.
I wasn't kidding, though, about being smart. Like, it seems like, you know, you'd have to have some kind of sharp wit to be able to come up with something like that at such a young age.
Oh, yeah. We are
Did you play it for your parents? What do your parents think of this? Were they worried?
I think my parents are so cool. They just like, they're like, whatever makes you happy, you know?
Right.
So when they saw us playing and we played at this pizza place, which there's a video that exists somewhere,
you know. Did you guys ever play Taco Land? Was that open then?
We never played there. We almost played there.
Okay.
Like several times. We saw a lot of shows. We saw the Dead Milkman there.
Oh, yeah.
And some other. Which was amazing, and some other things.
What was that like, going to punk shows in San Antonio? Was there a lot coming through there, or was there a demand for it? Was there like a little scene where everyone got together?
Yeah, I think there was a little scene, and it was pretty cool. I mean, it was sporadic. It's not like Austin where you can go see music every day.
Right. That's what I'm saying. But you know,
once
there was
every
a show.
3 or 4 months, something comes through that we would have to go see.
Right.
You know?
Dead Milkman. So, or
a really memorable one was seeing like the Red Hot Chili Peppers at this little place, and there was probably like 10 people in the audience. And
really?
It was like during their like first or second record.
Yeah.
I think Freaky Styley record.
Right.
I think Hillel Slovak was there and all that stuff. And that was just
how
so
was that?
Cool.
You remember a lot of it?
Yeah, that was another formative thing, really, seeing Flea and everything.
Yeah, I bet.
I mean, that really...
And you were playing guitar then, though, right?
I had started playing bass.
Okay. Well, that just must have been like a, you know, that's like, you know, if you were into guitar and saying Yngwie or something. But like, his is more applicable to a group thing as opposed to just a soloing thing.
Yeah, and I think I got put on bass, you know, because we had a great guitar player and everything, and so, and which I was, and I just grew to love it. I just liked playing bass. It was just.
There's a lot. I talked to Bruce Hughes about it, and he said the same thing. It was it isn't guys usually going out to play the bass, right? You know, you're a guitar player, and then they're, you need a bass player, and so somebody's got to do it. And so there's always one guy that's like, all right, well, I'll do it.
Exactly.
But then you get into it. There's guys like you and guys like Bruce that you get it, and all of a sudden, there's a new language you've learned. That's going on, a subtext in the music that you have total control over, which is pretty, you know, unbelievable.
Yeah,
and guys
really
like you
cool.
take advantage of it, you know? And you make songs, you know, bigger sounding than they are, and you give them new, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. It can make it...
So did you figure that out pretty fast?
Yeah, I think I figured that out, I think the sound appealed to me, too, because, like, you know, like I said before, I played trombone, and I was a bass singer.
Right.
In choir, I was a, you know, a baritone, and I liked singing those big, you know, low, know, parts and everything. And I just was attracted to the bass clef, you know. It was pleasing to my ear, and it makes my bones shake a little bit, you know. And it kind of like, it's like, I like thunderous, you know. Even today, I try to make my sound as thunderous as possible.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Hey, you have to.
When it's a... Appropriate. You know, like if you're playing with singer-songwriter, of course you're not going to be thundering all the time. But, that's why I love the bass. So.
Yeah.
And
what's that?
Once you're a bass player, everybody needs one.
Everybody needs one. Because
nobody needs a guitar player.
Nobody does, really.
There's plenty of those.
There's too many.
Yeah. So when you're a bass player, it's like all of a sudden you're in everybody's band, and you can move around, and you can... demand your price, and
so you spend a lot of time sitting around learning an instrument, and you spend a lot of time like I did at the same time too. So many trucks driving by and shit. This is gonna be interesting. It's like we're in a construction site or something. Yeah.
My kid would go crazy for that one.
Man, remember how exciting
that's a backhoe. He would tell you that what kind of backhoe that was.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's good. you sat around learning an instrument and you made yourself get pretty good. You saw someone like Flea. You spent a lot of time working on it. And this is just a side question.
Yeah.
Because you also teach. With the advent of like Rock Band, do you think that a lot of, do you think that inspires kids to go learn instruments, or is it just another video game that might not ever really... It might keep kids that might have actually learned an instrument and become musicians, have them make them not be, you know.
I think it definitely.
Does that make the question make sense?
Yes, okay. Definitely. I think it's a fair debate, and I think it definitely can inspire kids because they get the sensation of holding the guitar and being they are. You know, playing music, at least simulating playing music, and so maybe
so getting timing down
lights
and
a little
kind of,
spark in them. You know,
do you get kids that come in and want to learn? They're like, oh yeah, I played Rock Band for the last year and a half, and now I'm ready to do it. You're a Guitar Hero or whatever.
Yeah, occasionally,
yeah,
definitely. I mean, I teach at Rock Camp at the school, which which is awesome. I it's probably one of the most fun things that I get to do, and that's we gather these kids around and put together these little bands, and we teach them the songs, and I'm kind of like a drill sergeant. I make them sure that really really tight, and that the show is awesome, and you know, and then the big performances.
Do you guys,
each
of the teachers has a band that they do, or multiple bands that they do. Yeah. And so do you guys get competitive with each other? Like, are you like to Darren and Rusty, like, dude, my band's going to kick your band's ass this time, man.
I do. Not everybody does.
I don't see Darren being like that, but.
Yeah, I think it's healthy competition. I think it's funny, you know. I think it's entertaining.
Yeah.
And then sometimes my band is terrible and they're just going to flail and I'm like...
But sometimes the band might be really good.
Yeah, sometimes they turn it around. Sometimes it's like the worst, you know, by worst I mean like the most unnaturally talented kids and then they... But then you work hard and then they actually pull it together and have a great show and they're up there as like one of the best bands and everything. It's not a competition though. There's no ranking or anything. It's just... Right. It's just the spirit of doing your best and having a great show and learning
an instrument,
yeah.
Learning how to play, there's a social, they're working with other people,
absolutely,
being
that's
able
a
to
huge...
understand other people's shortcomings or being able to work with someone who might be a lot better than you.
Yeah, something. That's a huge thing. That's a huge thing is the teamwork aspect of it, and you know, so
hey, hang on just one second. So did you have any significant bands that played out and garnered followings or did anything when you were in San Antonio?
Well, yes, of course. The Gingerbread Men.
And they started in San Antonio.
Yes, we started.
You started in high school?
It started, yeah, towards the end of high school. Some of us were still in high school, some of us had just graduated.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
The Gingerbread Men.
Yeah, okay. just talk to me about the incarnation of the Gingerbread Men.
So one of my oldest and closest best friends, Henry Gutierrez. Henry and I were kind of the leaders, and then we had a horn section, and we had a couple of different drummers, but we definitely settled on Robbie Kidd for a while there. So it was like me, Henry, Rob Kidd, Ed McNames. Raul Vallejo was playing trombone.
I didn't realize
this guy
that
named
he was from,
Ducky
he,
from high school was playing saxophone. What's that?
Right. No, go ahead.
Yeah, and then and so, you know, we're playing the Black Cat on weekends. So we're driving up the Black Cat from San Antonio.
And you were in high school at this time?
Yeah. Or Just graduated.
Did you come and audition for, I guess I can get a collection of auditioning for Paul Sesame stories. What was your audition like?
I don't remember.
You know?
I think we opened up for Soul Hat or something.
Okay.
And then he liked us immediately. I don't remember auditioning.
This was 1988?
No.
This
was like 90...
Well, because weren't you at Rice before then?
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Yeah, I graduated high school in 88.
Okay.
So some of those guys, like Henry and stuff, had just graduated high school. He graduated. He's like 3 years younger than me.
Okay.
So I was like...
So you moved to Houston and started going to school. Did you have a band there?
In Houston? Yeah, I played in a few different bands in Houston and hung out on the band scene. One band
I was trying to think of this yesterday, more than today. Yesterday, in the morning, I knew you were coming over. I was trying to figure out when I met you, and I can't remember meeting you. I just kind of remember you being there and knowing you.
Yeah. Like, well, I think we were all just kind of there, like, in this steamboat scene.
Well, no. Even before then, like, in Houston, like, you know, I was in this
band, maybe
Pandurum.
Oh, okay.
And my guitar player from that band went to Rice. I had a lot of friends that I grew up with that went
right,
there.
Right, right. Uh-huh. Richard.
They were kind of in, Richard and Paul LaWare and Kelly Waddle.
Yeah.
And cats like this. I didn't know if you were part of that crew of guys.
I seem to remember you from the Sprawl.
Right, yeah.
Sprawl
I used to go there all the time.
Yeah.
To their house on Norfolk, Lexington or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, so like Sprawl was hugely influential. I was hanging out with them all the time. Of course, they were another punk funk band. They were so cool.
Right.
In fact, I'm still in touch with Matt Kelly, who's
he lives here now.
Yeah, who's a really, really good friend, and we keep running into each other.
Yeah, I run into him from time to time too. So this is cool because this is entering a thing. You guys were part of a thing that I was a part of for a while, I think, and Sprawl was a part of, and there was bands like Ten Hands, and there was a big movement in this area that was inspired by funk, world beat, and punk music. Like there was your funk punk bands, there was your funk rock bands, and then there was like your world beat funk bands.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then there was like the Bad Mother Gooses that had like rapping and stuff.
Yeah.
Awesome
time.
In Houston, what bands were you in there that I might know? And I'm sorry to anyone who's like sitting here going like, oh, I don't want to listen about Houston bands.
I think when I was in Houston, you know, I was so into school that I just played with like various that I can't even really name. I mean, I don't really.
And you were studying music there,
I think
too.
I was just like jamming with people, and I was studying music and going to a lot of shows.
Who were the bands that you would definitely always go see? Ten Hands, probably. Billy Goat, yeah.
Was definitely post-Ten Hands, in my top favorite.
Or not post Ten Hands, but a guy like a Ten Hands offshoot band.
And then when I saw, you know, Fishbone, I mean, my mind was blown by Fishbone.
Did you see Fishbone at Fitzgerald's?
Fitzgerald's.
Me too.
You were there?
Well, I don't know which show it was, but I saw him a couple times there.
Yeah, and it was, wow, that was an amazing. I don't think there's been very many live shows since that can compare to the sort of energy of Fishbone.
Yeah, I'd never.
In their heyday.
Yeah, it was very, like a late 80s Fishbone show was something to to see.
there
was so much stuff that people were so wild at those shows. There was so much stage diving. There was so much like this kind of communion between the band and the audience.
Yeah.
It was, you know, even though there was a separation, you were maybe up a couple feet higher than the audience.
Yeah.
There was a together, especially when you play at Zelda's on those things. Like the first time I ever saw Sprawl was at Zelda's. Like at some point in 87, one of their very first like club shows outside of playing like a school party.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was mad.
It was massive.
It was mad. Yeah. It was insane. I was so attracted to it. You know,
These
guys were, you know, unbelievable.
Yeah. I know, right?
The energy was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And even though I was more of a person that wrote the kind of music, I would say, like 20 years ago that I'm writing now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I took a left turn and said, I want to do this kind of music. This is where it's at, you know?
Yeah.
You don't wear shoes.
Mm-hmm.
You take your shirt off halfway through the show. It's all sweaty and intense and Texas-y.
Crazy things happen, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So where did you guys fit in all that, in the Gingerbread Men? You guys started then during the summer after, while you were still in Houston, or?
Yeah, and we played in the summers when I'd come back home from school, or we'd practice a little over Christmas break or something. And then I think we played at Fitzgerald's opening for Bad Mother Goose.
Yeah.
And so that was a classic show, we started getting like opening slots for all these like cool bands, Sprawl.
Right.
We played with them numerous times.
Yeah.
Billy Goat.
Yeah.
You know, we're always opening for Billy Goat or Sprawl, or, you know, and it was just like, it was just, yeah, it was a great thing.
So once you guys kind of, that was, were you still in school when you were doing those opening slots? Or are you saying that maybe then you guys, once you finished school, did you just come up here, like hightail it up here?
Around that time, I discovered the magical herb and sort of school fell by the wayside, and that's about when I went home for the summer. And
but you were going to Rice. You can't just, it's, that's not a fall by the wayside kind of school. It's like a little bit,
yeah,
it's,
but
not,
I was
like
pretty,
going to community college.
I was pretty
and
unhappy
a bunch
there
of,
because I wanted to study, I was so into music, and I wanted to study popular music and jazz and stuff like you can do at like a place like North Texas or even at UT.
And there they focus more on
all
on
classical.
Yeah.
Almost 100%. I think they had one or two classes that you could take that were jazz oriented. You could take like some jazz lessons, and then you could be in the jazz ensemble, and which I did. I played guitar in the jazz ensemble at Rice, and
What did you guys do? Like, did you play like in the lunchroom? Not in the lunchroom, but you know what
I
mean.
Well, you play like one concert a semester, you know, just in the whatever this recital hall or whatever.
And was it good? Was it good? Was it, or was it just like the same, you know?
It was a good band, but it wasn't enough for me. I wanted to play popular. I was kind of sick of classical music
right
at that point. of the world, you know, and school. I was rebelling against school, you know. I was like, all I wanted to do was play gigs and make money playing gigs.
I think that this is a good point to get to, because there's this sort of like, almost like you're shackled by these things. Like, school always seems to be like this thing that eats your whole, you know, there's so much you could do with your day.
Yeah.
You think then, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, there's so much I can be doing with my day if I didn't have this pesky, you know, fucking school to deal with.
Yeah.
On a constant basis.
And then once your grades start slipping, it's like a downhill slide. You're just like, you don't care anymore.
Were your parents bummed with you, or were they disappointed, or?
Well, I think they were scared. You know, they were scared about my future. But they tried to be supportive, because they understood that I was going to do what I wanted to do.
Right.
And chase my dream or whatever have you.
And I like how you didn't follow yours. You chased it. You chased it down.
I'm still chasing it. I'm still chasing it. I can't get it. It's an exhausting chase.
So,
as you know.
So you moved up here when school started going.
Yeah, and I moved up here in the summer of 1992 and lived on the floor of my friend's 2-bedroom house. And then once I moved up here and Henry moved up here
was Henry still living in San Antonio?
Yeah.
Okay.
The rest of the band decided we're going to all move in to this guy's 2-bedroom house.
Right.
Which we destroyed, and it was complete anarchy. And the next two houses were complete anarchy.
Like, what do you mean? Were they like, I wish we could tell all the Sprawl house. There was a house that this band Sprawl lived in Houston. That
I think that inspired us.
Yeah, that was an inspiring house. I used to go there. I lived in a regular home with just one roommate. I don't know if you knew Chris King, the bass player there in Houston.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He was my roommate there. And I remember we would go to these parties there. And when we'd get home, we'd be like, oh, thank God we don't. I mean, we had our fair share of parties, but we didn't have that.
Yeah.
The door's always open. People are always there. You know, you don't know who the fuck is in your house.
Yes.
You know.
Hippie house.
Yeah, hippie house.
We started to take on a lot of hippie ideals.
Yeah.
For lack of a better word.
And so at that time, you guys were playing. You were getting the band together. Or were you just in?
No, yeah, we were just playing gigs and making enough money off gigs to survive.
And so at that point, you were doing the weekly Black Cat.
Weekly Black Cat. And then what else? You were kind of
touring
regionally.
Yeah, touring. You had a van.
Regionally, we had a big van. Eventually, I mean, after a while, we had a big van and a trailer, and we had, you know, huge pieces of equipment. Like, I had this MPEG 8x10 speaker cabinet, which weighed about, who knows, 500 pounds or something, with a refrigerator like road case.
Right.
That
I often
have to recruit people to help me move it. And, you know, back in the day, let's say everybody was into the large, heavy amps, you know.
Yeah.
And now it's with technology, everything's lightweight. And
but now you have a 300 watt.
Thing that weighs 4 pounds.
It fits in your pocket.
Yeah.
So you guys toured, and what did you guys make records? You guys made records,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk me through how Gingerbread Men kept their thing going after you guys started that summer.
Well, Henry's dad managed us.
Okay. Was he a music manager, or was he just a savvy dad?
He was a savvy dad. He was really, really into his son. And he still is, actually. He's still there at every single show.
It's good.
For Henry's shows. And he just, you know, he was learning the business as he was going along. And he was just, you know, we made goals, like make a CD. You know, actually, the first one we did was cassette. We made a cassette.
Right, of course.
And then, and make CDs and make posters and call clubs and hassle them and all that kind of stuff.
And you guys had like a regular, were you playing like a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday every week, kind of like doing a regional
of
run?
Playing Houston, Dallas, and eventually going on the road a lot.
Right.
All over. So, right. And playing with some really cool stuff. We played with like Maceo Parker a lot, which was incredible.
Amazing. Did you ever get to hang out with them?
We hung out with them a lot, and, you know, just tried, they were very nice, and Maceo Parker Tower of Power, we played with a few times. Those are some of the memorable ones. P-Funk. And
there was also, you were going to tell me about a trifecta the other night when we were talking.
The Black Cat trifecta.
The Black Cat trifecta of Little Sister or Sister Seven.
Little Sister, they were called that. And Soul Hat and Gingerbread Man. We always played together at like Liberty Lunch and the Black Cat. And then I threw in Joe Rockhead too. Right. So it wasn't really, it was a quadfecta, actually.
Quadfecta. So what did you guys tour a lot together? Did you?
We played with them a lot, in various places.
Uh-huh.
Trees in Dallas and the Satellite.
Did you guys do a lot? Did you guys do like a lot? I remember at that time there was a lot of, and just because of our, I don't know who booked you at the time, or was it Henry's dad the whole time? Or did you eventually get with like a 214 or one of those kind of people that kind of...
Yeah, we eventually had these two frat boys, Bucky and Heggy, who started managing us. And they were real close to Widespread Panic. So,
that's what I said. Did you do like Colorado tours? Like I did.
Yes.
I always did.
Oh, we love the Colorado tour. Yeah, man, yeah. That was the best. Because then you ski all day and then you get the, you know, we'd go skiing and then we'd hang out in our condo that they would give us get paid and
did,
eat
how did
and
you
then
do,
move
did you
to
do
the
condos
town.
Like it like this Sproul House? Usually this condo's in disarray.
I think there was a high priority on weed smoking at that time.
No. Yeah, there was a
I remember one
time in the summer of I can't remember what summer it was, but we were on tour in Colorado and out of weed.
Yeah.
And we were going from somewhere to somewhere else, and there was a giant pass, but there was a sign that said fire danger is extremely high in the hills. And our bass player said, I keep on reading about this guy. And we're like, who? This fire danger guy. I think he's got some weed. He's extremely high and he's everywhere. So
that's hilarious.
That's a good. Did you play with bands like Zuba and these kind of like high times bands up there when you went up there?
Yeah.
We did whenever we went up there, like the Fox Theater in Boulder.
Fox Theater in Boulder. Man, that's a great place. Great place. I have a great story that I actually smoked weed with the bass player of the Wailers.
No
when
shit.
We opened for Bob Marley and the Wailers. Well, not actually Bob was dead.
Not,
it was just the Wailers with some other singer at the Fox.
Wow.
And smoked weed with Family
Man
Barrett.
Does it even affect him? Does he even notice he's smoking weed? Is it like having a cigarette, one of your 25,000 cigarettes of the day?
Well, I have this kind of funny story that I've told a couple times to some people, but like, I had this bag of expensive weed, you know, in my pocket, and I was like, oh, I'm going to go hang out with the Wailers. And so I go downstairs, and it's nothing but Rasta guys. I'm the only white guy
in
there.
And
I'm like, oh, this is so cool. I'm going to smoke out with the Wailers, you know. And then so I pull out my bag of weed, and I go, right. Hey, does anybody want to smoke some of my weed? And they're so cool, and they're just like, yeah, man. And they just grab, like, a whole handful of my $100 bag and throw it in one big joint.
Right.
And roll it up.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, that's, like, everything I have. But I didn't say anything because,
you
know.
What are you going to say? It's the Wailers.
And they
rolled
like
the
whole thing
Nelson
up.
Or something like that.
Whoa. Fire.
Yeah, fire danger is extremely high. On campus.
Anyway, so, yeah, I mean, that was, for me, that was, like, you know, a big deal. Oh, I smoked a huge spliff with the Wailers.
That would be like getting high with Willie Nelson or something like that.
Yeah.
Kind of like one of those things you probably should do.
Yeah.
If you're in that situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how long were you guys together? How long did you guys go as a band?
The Gingerbread Man.
For a while, yeah.
Okay. It was pretty long.
How many records did you put out?
I bet we didn't put out enough records. I think we did 3. Yeah, we did 3.
I hope this doesn't scare people, like people that are listening to this. If you're listening to this in your car, the cops are... I'm going to pause this. All right, I think the coast is clear now.
Okay.
So fire busted out and the fire trucks all split. So so you said you made 3 records?
Yes, we're kind of slackers. I think we could have made more.
That weed you were smoking.
Yeah, we could have made more. And then dissipated. I think I've done the math before. I think we were together about 6 or 7 years.
Okay.
Like solidly. You know, where we were like actually
right. And so,
a lot.
So what brought the end of that band? Was it, was your popularity waning? Did you do something that, you know, did you not find the next thing? That's a tough thing to do is when you keep a band together, like figure out,
yeah,
you know, like, what do you do next? You know what I mean? How do you keep it hard?
It was devastating, kind of, you know, it was like a big breakup.
Was it everyone's idea? Like, we just can't really go on like this anymore. We need to...
Well, I think it dissipated little by little, but it happened pretty quickly. It was just... I think one of the first things was, like, Raul took off, and he was kind of the glue in the horn section. He took off to play with the Scabs.
Right.
I think it was Ugly Americans first. It was the Ugly Americans.
Right.
And started a horn section with Carlos and Fernie.
Right.
And then our management were just, like, not impressed with us, and they kind of pulled out. And then...
That's always a sad feeling. I've had that where the management's like, yeah, you know what? And you're like, no. If you don't even like us, who's going to like us?
And honestly, I think we deserved it because I think we were slacking off a lot. I think we were, you know, not practicing enough. It was really hard to get people to practice, to have rehearsals and to write new music.
It took everyone to do all that stuff.
Yes, and I think I personally was pretty frustrated, and I started coming loose on people. By coming loose, I mean I'm a very passionate guy, and I think I had some anger issues that I don't really have much anymore.
Right, but back then, when I was young. Yeah, sure.
I would just... berate somebody in the band because they didn't make the rehearsal, and like that could be very harsh, and I don't know, it's just like a lot of our spirit was kind of broken, and it was a tough time, but you know, we all learned how to move on. So
yeah, so then you moved on. What did you do immediately after that? What was your... did you lay around? Did you
No, I never stopped playing. You know, this is what I always wanted to do for a living. So I've always been playing in bands. So I had a band. It was like a jazz group with Ephraim Owens. I got into jazz and Jaco Pastorius and stuff. And so I had this jazz group with Ephraim and Henry and Michael Hale and/or Michael Longoria called Concerto Grosso. And
then I remember that.
We played a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we played a lot of jazz settings.
Yeah.
And we played I remember we opened for Roy Hargrove and did some cool stuff like that. And then I got in a Soul Hat. With Soul Hat.
Sort of in the late 90s.
And Kevin McKinney. So I played with Soul Hat and Kevin McKinney for a long time. Probably about five or six years. And that was a good time for me, fertile time. Although it was kind of up and down for Soul Hat, the band itself,
because it wasn't like a fully running machine at that point, or was it? It was trying to get back into it.
He was trying to get back into it. Made one record, but I think it was frustrating because they used to be, you know, the darlings of Sony Records, and now then at that point they were sort of...
Were you guys still on Sony at the point when you did that?
No, we had some other label from Atlanta, Terminus Records, and then. Uh-huh. You know, so I did that for a while, and then ever since then, I've just been, you know, playing with everybody, it seems like. I played with Bob Schneider for a while, and of course, most recently, my favorite person to play with, Susanna Schaufel.
Yes.
Who I adore.
She's very popular on this podcast.
Yes. And she's just a great person to play with and work
she's
with.
She's a great person.
She let me collaborate and write some of her songs with her.
So you had some co-writing on the new album?
Yes.
And you played on the new album?
I played on the new
Good.
Album.
Good, that'll give me something now. I know what all I should play when when I do this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
So, who else? You played with Bob. Didn't you go on a one of those Dixie Chicks tours with them?
Yes, I did.
How tours. Was that? What was that like, playing in the big arenas? Was that after she had insulted the president?
It was,
like that?
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was right when that movie, right when their movie was coming out, the Shut Up and Sing movie.
Right. Mm-hmm. I forgot about that. That was a really good movie.
And it was right when Borat came out. I remember that because me and Bob went together to go see Borat when it first came out, and that killed me. I mean, I laughed so hard.
How did you get along with him?
With Bob?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
A good guy.
I really like Bob a lot. We're good friends. I mean, he's really cool. He was always really nice to me, and we got along well. We sometimes get the kids together. You know, our kids are almost the same age.
Oh right.
I just respect him so much because he's such a hard worker.
He is a hardworking guy.
He is a hardworking guy. Yeah, I mean, he does have issues like every rock star, and, you know, we all know what
we
issues.
We all have issues.
Everyone has issues.
Everyone has issues.
I accept him for who he is, and I think he's a great guy.
That's good.
Yeah.
So on those big tours that I was trying to get at, was it more fun to play like the giant stages and come out and be the opening act for the Dixie Chicks, or was it more fun to do a 3-hour show at the Black Cat?
I did not like the Dixie Chicks tour, honestly. I was pretty bored and lonely with it, honestly.
Yeah?
Yeah. It was awesome because there was catering and we had buses.
Right, this is
all that stuff was in place. But we played for about 45 minutes.
And you like to play longer.
Yeah, I mean, I got in the business to play music, not to hang around in cold hockey arenas, you know, looking for somebody that knows me or whatever. I was looking for some friends. It was weird. I mean, it was cool. It was an honor to do it, and, you know, it paid well and everything like that. But I much prefer the intimacy of playing in a club setting where you are right there with the people. And after the show, you can meet a lot of people and feed off their energy and play for a long time. I like that kind of thing.
You know,
that's what I feed off of.
So we played for a long time this weekend in Skyrocket.
It was killing.
Yeah.
It was rock and roll.
I forgot you weren't there on. I was gonna talk about playing in a barn one day and then playing in a on a golf course.
I was there on the Saturday.
So.
It was fun.
It was fun, man.
It was a blast.
It was really good. You did a really good job. That's a lot of songs to learn. 45 songs in 1 week, and he played them like a champion.
Like a champ.
Yeah.
Well, some of them just, those one songs from the 80s, I mean, I was just having an out-of-body experience playing, like, you know, Just Like Heaven and stuff, because I'm like thinking, I grew up with playing, I mean, listening to this.
Sure.
It plays itself.
Yeah.
I don't have to like think, oh, what's the form again?
Right.
It's like, it's there. I know every lyric.
It's funny though, when you come across one you don't really know, because all those songs are like that with me. They're like, I don't ever have to, but every once in a while I get a song that maybe I didn't like, or maybe I didn't happen where I lived at the time. So I actually don't know the song.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, there was a few of those.
It's weird when there's those songs, because you know all of them so well. It's like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
songs you don't realize you know all the words to, songs you know the key changes in your head probably without ever even playing it.
That's when my eyes on stage get really big and I start listening to everyone else and watching people's hands, watching Corey's hands and asking Paul, you know, dude, what key is this in again? And like watching Darren, that's the thing, is like as a sideman, you have to be very sort of alert on stage sometimes.
And
like
listen.
When you don't know what's happening, then you just have to. Yeah, and so I've gotten really good at that over the years.
Right.
Just improvising. I think that's, you know, I think, like, there were a few songs that I think that I, don't tell Darren, but that I didn't even listen to. And I picked them up on stage.
That's a lot of songs to try and do in a week.
No, there's I did listen to them once or twice.
Yeah, there's got to be some that you leave for the last minute because you know, like, okay, this isn't going
to... Because there's ones with more involved bass lines.
Like, should I stay or should I go or something
to,
like that?
Yeah, is right. I did not listen to Should I Stay or... But I played that in my high school talent show, I think, so...
How did you do in your high school talent show? Do you remember? A lot of people don't remember. Bruce Hughes told a long story, and it was so involved about this talent show and how he got into music because of this talent show, and then he couldn't remember if he won or not. I thought that was weird.
I don't remember it well. I remember we played One Way or Another.
You played, like, did you just play
and I remember that it wasn't
Skyrocket's sets?
Yeah, I think so. We basically played the Skyrocket set. No, we played One Way or Another, and it was bad, I think.
Yeah.
I remember as it being... I would never want to hear, like, the recordings of it, because I think it was probably pretty crappy.
So what do you have now? You have school? Susanna moved to New York. I know that that's empty, but you guys are still going to be playing together. I'm sure you'll be going up there to visit, and she'll be playing down here a lot.
Well, it's funny. It's like all of a sudden, you know, since Susanna's moving, I'm starting to get... People are starting to call me because they're
they know your
it's a great,
are
it's
free
a good
now.
Thing. It's a great thing because I was worried, you know, that maybe I wouldn't, you know, as a musician, you always kind of like live from gig to gig. And it's like, I was worried. I was like, well, who am I going to play with? But now it's like my phone's ringing and I just can't, I mean, I can't even do everything everybody's asking to do. And okay, for this weekend, I'm playing with Susanna, David, Kat Edmondson, and Jason Blum out of this festival in Presidio.
It's fucking awesome.
Four bands.
It's a lot of bands.
This
I love
weekend,
Kat.
I love, adore Kat.
Yeah.
Kat, me and Johnny G, we love you.
Yeah, yeah. She's been on the podcast.
She's wonderful. And so, so that's going to be awesome.
How do you like
and,
playing with David? That's fun, right? That's one of my favorite
dudes roller coaster.
Of all time. Yeah.
Roller coaster ride of fun.
Like an E.
I adore him. Yeah. I adore him. But he doesn't rehearse. He doesn't tell you what he's going to play.
No.
You just have to kind of know his songs and roll with whatever's going to happen on stage. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen.
He's so... he's just really in tune, you know? He's so in the moment as a musician. He's always so present in the music that you never get the feeling that it's ever anything. He's giving half-assed. Even when he picks up a ukulele at your house or something, it's like this fucking, like, you know, he's there. He's with this instrument making this music at that moment. It's not an afterthought.
I know. He's brilliant. And pretty much any instrument he touches, he's just brilliant at it, like, right away. Like piano or guitar.
I hate him.
And singing, it's just...
And he's prolific.
He's amazing. He should be
him.
He should be famous. He should be famous. He should have $1 million hit, you know. Maybe he will.
Wait, he's got a lyric. I never sold 1 million records, but I got 1 million hits. That's a line from one of his songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's fun and funny and fun to hang out with.
Yeah.
I adore him.
And so anything else? But yeah, do you think you'll ever try and start a band again, like a band?
I will. I kind of got to get my bearings with the
school,
with the school, and paying the bills with playing some gigs, and you know, and then I mean, I also write songs on my own. I have some stuff that I eventually one day I'd like to do a Johnny V solo thing.
Yeah, man.
You know, everybody wants to do that. It's narcissism, and I'm also playing with Drew Smith, who's great.
He's great. Yeah.
And this girl singer, Megan Carney, who I think is super talented.
Yeah, I talked about her this weekend. I don't know.
So I'm playing with her a bit. I want to do some recording with her because I think she's got a ton of potential. And
you ever do any producing or anything?
Yeah. In fact, me and my cousin Eddie Hobazal, who's this amazing piano player, want to start like a production company where we produce people, because he has a studio gear, and we want to sort of partner up, like, his talents with my talents match well.
And cousins too.
And we're cousins.
Cool. I'm close with my cousins.
And so we've done a few things over at his house, and and now we're like sort of thinking more seriously, like maybe we can make a website and get some singers in there who want their songs produced. So if there's anybody out there who wants their songs produced,
look up Johnny Bogle Sang. You guys have a site, or you can find you on website. I mean, on Facebook, on website.
We're working on it.
You're working on it?
Yeah, we have like a weekly meeting where we talk about what we want to do with this thing, and he's got every sound. First of all, he's an amazing piano player. He went to HSPVA, and I think he placed in the Thelonious Monk piano competition when he was young, and he could pretty much play anything, but you know, he likes playing pop music. So, and then he has like a million sounds, like string sections and analog synths and drum machines and just literally at his fingertips with his computer and everything. So we thought that he'd do all that, and then I would play guitar and bass on things, and then we would like contract out drummers to make tracks, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So, yeah, and you're getting some great sounds over there. So, I mean, that's another thing that I'm working on. So I'm working on a million things at once, always. So.
Yeah, like we all are.
Yeah.
Well, Johnny, thank you. It was good to hang in with you and playing with you this weekend.
Yeah, man.
And I'm glad that we got to.
Yeah, we got the Johnnies to together.
Yeah. V&G, baby.
Yeah, buddy.
All right.
High five.
All right, this is Johnny Bogle Sang, my guest today, and I guess we'll be seeing you soon. So that went well. It was weird because there were so many birds in that thing. It was almost like it was at a fucking parrot jungle or something in Miami. Anyway, I'm still in the tub. You'll be hearing from author Bruce Mahart. You'll be hearing from Taylor Muse from Quiet Company. And you'll be hearing from Kelly Willis. And you'll be hearing from a lot more musicians. So anyway, stay tuned. That was episode 19. That was Johnny Voglesang. And here's some more Susanna Schaffel music featuring Johnny Voglesang on the bass. See you soon.
I'm trying to preserve my word. Not a sound should be heard unless it's beautiful. very tragic affair.